Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is September 16th, 2004. Today's session number is WEJ2004-01. Today's speaker is Jennifer Wirtz. The lesson for today is Fade to Gray, a Modern-Day Missionary in Kenya. Let's listen in.
But yeah, my name is Jen Wirtz. I was an ELCA, 1 year missionary personnel for the Christian ELCA Church. I was in Kenya.
Yes.
Where did those initials mean?
Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. Yeah. So I was on the mission personnel staff. I was in Kenya. I was in the far southwest corner of Kenya among the Luo tribe. In Kenya, their national language is Kiswahili, and the official language is English, so there are sort of two required languages. But then there are 42 different tribes, each of which have their own mother tongue. So most Kenyans speak three different languages. So I was, of course, teaching in English, but I was not teaching English as a second language, because English is supposed to be one of their first languages. Okay, so Kenya is it is a democracy. It has a presidency. It was it won their independence from Great Britain in 1963. It's located in East Africa, if you don't know. I don't know. Do you have any questions about the demographics of Kenya at all?
What do you mean by demographics?
Any of the
population?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's population. I think it's not important.
Male, female ratio, age. Ratio, black, white.
Okay, not that specific. it is not like South Africa in that there's an equal population of white and black. It is definitely Kenyan. The Kenyan population is mostly made up of 42 tribes of Kenya, as well as a significant Indian population. When they were building the railroad through Kenya back in the late 19th century. A lot of Indians migrated from India to help build the railroad, and they have a fairly significant population in Nairobi, especially. So that's the majority of the ethnic groups, and then most of the Westerners that are there are either volunteers or some teaching positions, but often a lot of church-associated people, or Peace Corps, things like that. So anyway, I guess I just kind of wanted to start by asking you what some of your associations are when you think of Africa. If you know Kenya specifically, then specifically Kenya. But what are some of the things that you think of when you think of Africa?
Safari.
Safaris.
Yes.
Afterwards.
Mm-hmm. What else?
The legacy of the Mau Mau.
The Mau Mau.
The legacy of the Mau Mau.
Indeed. That's for those who don't know, the Mau Mau are the freedom fighters of the Kenya's independence. They were instrumental in Kenya's. That's another interesting thing, but a lot of Kenyans who have higher upper level education don't stay in Kenya. They don't have their highly educated workforce there. Most of them are in the United States and in Great Britain.
Kenyan
service. No, it's
okay.
I think I can do it from here. Some of the things that people often associate with Africa. Sunsets, colors, music, rhythm, drums, AIDS. Darfur, it's been really big in the news in Western Sudan. Body piercings, poverty, beads, corruption. Corruption is a big theme in Africa and many different countries. These are a lot of things that people think of and associate with. Some of them are accurate, some of them are not. Actually, all of them are accurate to an extent, I guess, but especially the Lion King. I went to the park where that inspired all the drawings from Lion King. It's stunning. But, okay, so I was actually a missionary for the ELCA church. It was interesting being a modern-day missionary. The word missionary has a very negative stigma attached to it in a lot of contexts. And it's something that I shied away from a little bit because I was afraid of how I would be interpreted. When I told my home congregation that I was going to be a missionary in Kenya, someone actually came up to me and said, "Praise God for going there to save those people." It's still out there. It's still an attitude that's there. I come from Midtown, small town America, and a lot of people just don't understand. They don't know. In fact, in Kenya, I think the percentage of people who profess the Christian faith is about 90%. It's high. It's really high. Now, that's a complicated issue because that's a lot of a nominal Christian faith. Just under the surface, there's a lot of traditional practices, a lot of witchcraft in the community where I was living. A lot of witchcraft is going on. A lot of that just underneath, working sometimes in conjunction with Christianity, sometimes in opposition to Christianity. But some of the objectives of the ELCA Church. Things that we were taught to think about before we left were especially do not go there with the mindset that I'm there to help. Do not go there to help people. We are way past those days in the mission stage. We are not going there to help anymore. We're going there in mutuality and in an attempt to have a symbiotic relationship with our brothers and sisters on the other side of the world. Second of all, not to objectify people's suffering. I wrote a lot to people, to family and friends at home while I was away. And I had to be very conscious about not writing sob stories or not writing Oprah Winfrey stories for people to glorify or romanticize about my time in Kenya. I didn't want people to get inspired to send money to their pet Africa project so they could people could feel like they made a contribution to Africa. Like that was definitely not one of my objectives and something that I had to consciously avoid. Another things to be careful about oversimplifying the issues. There are a lot of problems in Kenya and in Africa, but Kenya specifically. And it's really easy from the outside to say, well, why don't you just do this? Why don't you fix it this way? But you have to give them the credit that if the solution was that simple, they already would have done it. So the issues go a lot deeper than I expected them to. By the time I left, after having been there for one whole year, I was just realizing that I was at the tip of an iceberg. I didn't realize how deep all the problems and the issues and the situations in Kenya go. And had I been there 10 years, maybe I would have only begun to have a grasp on what the people have been dealing with and struggling with for decades. Similarly, there are no easy answers to those solutions or to those problems. A friend of mine worked for the New Sudan Council of Churches. He's an American man. And we saw in a Newsweek article, I think it was Newsweek, maybe it was Time, we saw in a Newsweek cover a picture of a certain American. And then the caption, "How do we fix Sudan?" Because Darfur has been a big topic in the news lately. How do we fix Sudan? And my friend Ross's response to that was, "Well, what do you mean fix it? What, like a hammer and nails? How do we go about fixing Sudan? Like this is..." They've been in trauma for 40 years. Like, the country has been in turmoil for a long time. We can't just go fixing these things. So we thought this was a really funny story, you know, how do we fix Sudan, haha. And he went home to a Christmas party in the United States over the holidays and brought up this question. "Hey guys, guess what I read? How do we fix Sudan?" And there was this eerie silence in the room, and everybody was like, "I don't know." And after a couple minutes, someone was like, "Ross, I don't know, it's a really good question. How do we fix Sudan?" And that's just such the American mentality, like this problem, how do we go about fixing it? But the issues are so much more complicated and deeper than we can understand. And it's often a fault of the American mentality that we can go in and fix the problems of the rest of the world. Okay. There's the adage that everyone's familiar with. I just skipped it. Okay, well anyway, the adage is, that give a man or give a person a fish and she'll eat for a day. Give her, teach her to fish and she'll, does it like teach her to fish and she'll have food for a lifetime. So you're all familiar with that. But kind of the new way to think about that is that what we need to consider is, well, why aren't they fishing already? I mean, why should we have to teach them how to fish? They should have the skills and the ability and the resources to fish themselves. So why aren't they fishing already? Is there a fence around the pond? If there's a fence, who put up the fence? Is there... If there's a fence up, is there a way in? And if you can get in, what would be the consequences of getting in? And those are actually questions that I had to ask myself a lot while I was at school, especially concerning issues of corporal punishment and school violence. I had to actually think about those a good deal. I came to realize that there are no obvious solutions, and even the problems are not always well defined, and that there is no black and white, which is the sort of theme of what I wanted to talk about, that there is no black and white, and the truth often lies somewhere in the middle. About 7 months into my year, we were at district drama festivals. I'd taken a group of students with a play that we had put together, we had written ourselves, and we were performing it at the district drama festivals. And that's probably another story for another day. But at one point, one of my students, one of the girls, came up to me, and she was touching my hair. They love to play with my hair. And she said, "Mwalimu," which is the Kiswahili word for teacher. She said, "Mwalimu, you have become so brown." And I was like, I was just shocked, because I think what she meant was just that I'd gotten tan from the sun. But it meant so much more. Like she was saying to me, "You're no longer white to me, with all of the things that whiteness entails. You no longer have the stigmas to me." Just as to me, my students were no longer black Africans, and all of the associations, which we showed earlier, they were no longer that. They were no longer that stereotype or that association to me. We'd all somehow faded to brown in the middle. And so that student's comment, kind of got me thinking about that middle ground, sort of the gray area in between, and that we as an American people like to categorize, we like to compartmentalize, especially Africa. We like to tie it up into these neat little boxes. We tend to put it into one of two categories, either the tragedy, which is sickness, violence, poverty, AIDS, death, suffering that you often see on commercials for aid programs, or the romance, which is, you know, the beauty, the art, music, generosity, culture, the wisdom of the people. I expected to go to Kenya and maybe encounter humble people who were generous and willing to welcome me to their homes, and they were wonderful musicians and had a lively style of praise and worship, and as it turned out, that wasn't the case. That was a side that I erred on. I had false expectations in that area. But those are kind of the black and white things, or the white and the black, depending on how you define, or the symbolism that's associated with white and black. But as with most things, the truth kind of lies somewhere in the middle, oftentimes. Mwalimu, you become so brown. So in these following topics that I've kind of put up, or the issues, as we like to call them from this side, from this hemisphere, I have chosen a specific symbolism for the colors black and white. And I know that there is a danger in giving meaning to the colors black and white. But in this case, I've used the label black to identify or to describe the situation they're facing, black Kenyans. That's the issue, is under the label of black. And then under the label of white is the perspective that we as white people or as Westerners have of that situation. And then sort of the gray area in between. First of all, there's the issue of, and if you have questions along the way or comments to add, please interrupt me. It'll be tedious to listen to me, so. Okay, women's empowerment was the first one. So, the black. Boys are given priority over girls in education. If family has a lot of kids, two boys and six girls, the boys will be sent to school first. Education is expensive. Most families can't afford to educate all their children. Many women are forced into sexual intercourse with their husbands and boyfriends, even when they know that their partner is infected with HIV. Kenyan women don't have a voice to say no about that most times. In the cities, that's changing. But in my community, I mean, very rural and remote community that very much operates outside of sort of contemporary thought. And then another issue is that women carry all the responsibility of the home and the family. Often they are responsible for raising the money to educate their children. So women carry a lot of weight in society. The white perspective of that is to develop community programs. And these are things that all exist in Kenya. Community programs that where women can have a safe space to talk about their fears and their concerns. We have counseling programs. For women who feel like they need someone to talk to. And then we also have, there are a lot of clinics all throughout Kenya that offer birth control and family planning options for women. In and of themselves, they're not bad ideas, but the reason why they don't work are the following. In my community, specifically in my community, there was very little trust between women. There's very little trust between women. Women were often kind of backstabbing and jealous of one another. My closest friend, Judy, we loved each other a great deal, but she was building a house at the time that I was there. And so the women in the village or in the marketplace would say kind of nasty things about her just because of our relationship, because they felt like she was going to get an unfair advantage through her friendship with me. That I was a free ticket to the United States for her, that I was building her house for her. And I know she didn't tell me nearly half of all the things that were said about her, but I know that just because of her relationship with me, she had a hard time in the community of women in our village. So there's not always a sense of community among women. So having a safe sharing space isn't always an option because women don't trust one another. And I'm aware that that's a large statement to make, but in my setting, that was definitely a reality. Second of all, do women's rights do them any good when they're not enforced in the court of law? They're represented in the court of law. Technically, they're there. But if a woman takes a man to court and accuses him of something, it never actually stands up. Nothing will ever come of it. The law will always rule in favor of the man. And hopefully in the future, that will be something that changes. But right now, it's definitely a reality. And if a woman, I lived in a polygamous society, so if a woman refuses to have children and can't handle the financial responsibility or the financial burden of having a lot of children and decides to opt for family planning, what's to stop her husband from marrying a second, third, or fourth wife who doesn't mind having a lot of children? A woman who chooses family planning and birth control often risks being socially ostracized from the community, because she has rejected the core values of the community, which are family and children. Another big issue is, of course, AIDS in Kenya. The facts are that in 20 years, if nothing changes, half of Africa's population will have died. Somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million Kenyans are infected with HIV/AIDS, and there's no one to raise an entire generation of orphans in Kenya and all over Africa. And it's going to lead to greater poverty and even greater economic decline for a country that's already struggling to keep its head above water. Most days it doesn't. So I guess the white response to that is we've instituted HIV/AIDS awareness by educating people about how the virus is transmitted, teaching people about safe sex. There have been billions of condoms donated to African countries. They even produce their own. Kenya's got their own condom manufacturing company. And also, there are current projects that are researching finding funding to provide free retrovirals for infected people. Which is complicated. Kind of the gray of these things there are a lot of cultural taboos that work against the dialogue about AIDS. In my community, there's a word called chira, that means it's a sickness that people come down with for breaking a taboo. And it's a sickness that has AIDS-like symptoms. In reality, it is, of course, AIDS. But the word chira does not have the negative stigma of the word AIDS. So people don't use the word AIDS. They use chira, or they call it malaria, or they call it tuberculosis, or typhoid, or any of the other sicknesses that people die from regularly. It's never labeled with the word AIDS because it has a negative stigma in the community that hasn't yet been removed from society. So there's no dialogue about it. When there's no dialogue, then it's hard to get people to take it seriously because it's still so much in the closet. It's just not something that people want to talk about. And second of all, men are not often, they're not the ones at the greatest risk for AIDS and HIV during intercourse. Women are at much greater risk. So often, men have little to be gained by wearing condoms. And so in the rural areas, where a lot of younger girls' priority is to get a man that will give them their status in society as a wife, often a woman will compromise her own safety in order to secure a man. I suppose if she insisted that he use a condom, many would, but many women don't insist because they don't want to take that risk. And another issue is that this is kind of a dangerous topic because retrovirals are needed. So many people are infected. Retrovirals might be the only thing that can turn around or slow down or turn around the situation. But if people are given free retrovirals, then there's no consequence. There's no need for prevention. There's no need for dialogue. And then there will be just a decline in sexual responsibility. Because what's the point of preventing it and wearing condoms and learning safe sex and transmission if you've got a way to fix it once you've got it?
What's retrovirals?
Oh, I'm sorry. They're sort of the drugs that you treat AIDS with, like AZT.
But there being no cure, it's still just a life prolonging.
Exactly.
Okay.
Which time do I have? 15 minutes. Okay. One of the other big issues is corporal punishment. This was a very big issue to me because I was working in a secondary school. We had 15 teachers and 350 students. So if you do the math, it's not a great teacher-to-student ratio, especially for high school. The black issues are that caning and verbal abuse are used liberally in the educational system. They are technically illegal, but teachers were never given an alternative. They were never taught another way to discipline their students. And so these are still the things that are used, especially in rural areas. What else? Oh, in all levels, different levels of society, fear is used to keep people in control, in the government, in the families, and in the school system. Like the government under Moy, who was the president before this one, a lot of people were political prisoners, political detainees, people were tortured, punished, whatever, for speaking out against the government. So people learned quickly that fear is an effective way to keep control of people. Similarly, children and their parents. I've heard several of my friends told me, in regards to their father, you don't respect your father, you fear your father. And it's very much sort of the role that a father has in a lot of families to keep control over his kids by thinking in fear. For me, I had to think of sort of the white perspective. Okay. But, I should find an alternative method of positive reinforcement or punishment or discipline for my students. Because I personally, for my own personal convictions, I cannot cane a student. That was also very, very complicated. Didn't end up being as easy as I hoped. Yeah, go to the next one. Okay, so the gray issues. Our, as in white people, our methods of discipline aren't necessarily effective within that context. The Kenyan educational system is vicious. Students have this big national exam at the end of the year, and all of their hopes and dreams are built upon how well they perform in this exam. And therefore, in order to get ahead in their classes, my students would do anything to cheat on exams. They knew every trick in the book. And our methods of discipline don't work with them. You can't offer to give, you can't give them demerits, little white pieces of paper that once you add up, that they spend, you know, a whole day in the study hall, essentially. Because for them, they wake up at 4 a.m. so that between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m. before classes start, they can study for 4 hours. So punishing them with studying doesn't work because they crave the time to study anyway. And you can't threaten to send them home because they're sent home all the time. Education is expensive, and most poor people can't afford the fees for education. So often the headmaster will send home a student to collect some school fees and tell them not to come back until they can find, until they can bring back a little bit of money with them. So the student might miss 1 or 2 weeks of class, sometimes more. And then when the exam comes around, they fail the exam because they weren't there for the material. So sending students home is not an effective method of discipline either. It was just a different context. The things that we do don't work.
What about failing them?
Yeah. Kind of. You mean for misbehaving or for not doing their work? Or?
Well, they cheat.
For cheating? Right. I did that a lot, and unless you can prove that they cheat, or catch them in the act, it's really hard. If you can catch them, then yes, I definitely failed them every time. But when it looked like a paper was copied off the person next to you, it wasn't necessarily anything you could do to prove that they did. Because, of course, at the end, they'll swear to you that they didn't. And I had 80 to 90 students in a classroom, and in a small classroom, so you can't keep them from looking at the table next to them. I mean, there's 3 people packed onto a bench. So there were just too many students in the classroom for one teacher to look after, so discipline was complicated. And also because fear has been just indoctrinated into students, it's the only thing that they respond to. The other methods that I tried, they didn't respond to, but when another teacher would hit them, it always worked. Like if one of my students was given a chemistry assignment and an English assignment from my class, and they've only got time to complete one assignment, do they complete their English assignment and then get beaten the next day because they didn't do their chemistry assignment, or do they do their chem assignment and then get a stern talking to from their English teacher? Fear wins every time. It's still there because it's effective. Fear works. I was never able to find a successful alternative to caning. In the end, I won my students' respect, and that was the best thing that I had going for me. But I never found a successful way to get them to come to class, do their homework, etc. It was a lot more complicated than I ever expected it to be. School violence is another big topic, especially in Kenya right now. By school violence, I mean that riots are really a popular form of protest among students. They riot for various reasons, but it's often to sort of express their own frustrations to the administration or to manipulate the administration into doing what they want. It's very in vogue to burn down buildings, laboratories, libraries, classrooms, houses, dormitories. People die all the time.
What are the ages of the people that are doing this?
High school students.
Okay.
And college students. College, in the universities, it's a bit different. The police get involved. At the high schools, often the police don't get involved. Yeah.
What kind of media they see, I mean, in the TV, what kind of programs or what did they see? From where did they take all the violence?
From the country. They've been taught that violence is an effective way to get people's attention. To, if people are scared, they'll do what you want.
What's the media? I mean, the TV, what kind of
media? Where I was, we had no media. In the cities, there is access to that, and it's an influence, but where I was, there was not. And also, students and teachers are often killed, either caught in burning buildings, or sometimes if the student's beef is with the teacher will be dragged out of their home, beaten, etc. We did have a riot, a strike at my school over the last weeks that I was there. Okay, so from our perspective, you know, the law should intervene. Why doesn't the police get involved? Students who incite riots should be punished. There should be some sort of consequence. The school administration should be using the funds appropriately to provide for the students, but often they don't. Corruption is an issue on all levels of society in Kenya, and administrations often misuse school fees. And the administration should be encouraging and teaching about peaceful demonstration and nonviolent resistance. The problems are that, well, students strike over various things. Not enough meat in the cafeteria. They haven't had beef recently, or the food hasn't been well enough prepared, or quality food. They might strike because another student has cheated on an exam and has had an unfair advantage, so they might attack that student. They might strike because they feel like the administration has not provided enough teachers for them. Without enough teachers, they won't learn the material and therefore will perform poorly on their national exam. What else do they strike about?
What did they strike about for your last?
At our school, they were attacking a specific teacher who they felt was caning them too liberally, who was beating them too often. So they attacked his home and he had to escape in the middle of the night. And they also attacked another student who they accused of being a devil worshiper. So the reasons for strikes range from the valid to just the absurd. But it's become a very popular method of expression.
Would there be much percentage going from school to college or to university?
No, there isn't.
Very small percentage.
Very small percentage. You've got to score in a very, very top bracket of your national exams to be accepted into university. And then if you have your own money, great, you can go. But almost no one has their own money to pay for university.
Name is their cost, not their ability.
Right, yeah, it's a matter of cost. So then it's even a smaller bracket at the top that is sponsored by the government to go to the university. So yeah, it's a very small percentage that is able to go on. But those who do go on are the brightest and the best. There's often not enough money to run school properly. Sometimes that's the administration's fault, sometimes it's not. But often if a headmaster sees a promising individual, a promising student, the headmaster will accept the student into the school and then waive the fees in hopes that person will perform well on the national exam and build up the reputation of the school. The result is that there's not enough money in the school system because so many students are going there free of charge. They're not paying their fees, and therefore there's no money to pay for resources like libraries, computers, and laboratories.
And how many times can they take the exam?
As many times as they want. If they fail it the first time, and they can afford to reset for their entire Form 4 year, which is the senior year, they can reset for their senior year 5 or 6 times and hope to get better scores each time.
Free each time? And
no, but you'd have to find someone to source to pay for your education to do that. Yeah, but many of them try to repeat as often as they can. Because the number of teachers are so few and the students are so many, it's really hard to control the mob mentality. It's very dangerous. And often there just aren't enough teachers to control the violent strike situations. During university strikes, universities are all in cities. The police often intervene with tear gas. There's a lot of stone throwing, a lot of tear gas canisters that are thrown. And that's what happens with the colleges. And the reason why all this happens is that the students have learned enough that they know that they should have rights. They know that they're individuals. They know that they deserve to have a good education, even though there isn't the money to give them the education they deserve. But they know that they deserve it. But they haven't learned responsibility for themselves. They haven't learned how to go about it peacefully or in a responsible way. They've got adult ideas with kid minds. I mean, they're the same as high schoolers here, but just a little more powerful there, I guess.
So, but that means more or less the teachers are sort of caught in the middle on both sides?
Yeah, because they've kind of got to appease the students on one hand. They've got to look out for their own safety. They don't want to get a bad look in public's perspective. They don't want the public saying, oh, that's not a safe school. I won't send my kid there. So they got to look good in the public's eyes. They want to appease the students. And they want to cost as little money for themselves. They want to spend as little money as they can.
And the administration hasn't coerced the corruption too, pretty much?
Oftentimes. It's kind of hard to avoid. I mean, I can't say everyone, but oftentimes.
Is education free
It is free up until standard 8, which is our equivalent of 8th grade. After that, high school, the 4 years of high school are it's not free, it's not subsidized by government. So, and for them, it is fairly expensive to go through 4 years of school. It's a pretty huge financial commitment on the part of the parent. Let's see, what else? Right, so strikes still happen, as with caning. It happens because it works. Fear is effective and fear is powerful. Nonviolence has been talked about. They're aware that it's a possibility, but nonviolence takes more time. And why use an approach that takes time when you can do this and you get immediate results?
Are you the one to administrate the caning, or
to the I was pressured to. The teachers wanted me to, but it was never something that I felt comfortable with. Other than that, it's all the teachers do it.
All the teachers do it.
Mm-hmm. And also the head boys, the sort of the student leaders also. It's usually a thin stick that you use on the back of the legs or on the back.
Now, what do head boy is it?
It's
authority over.
It's kind of like a class president, but a little bit more serious.
But like, for what things are they allowed to clean?
Oh, like if a student sleeps through class and they go through the dormitory and find someone sleeping who is not sick, but they find someone who's cut class, they find someone who. Is not where they're supposed to be at a given time of the day, things like that. I'm sort of keeping order among the students. Yeah, so.
Probably the other question I was thinking is being caught in the middle, was there any way of teachers having any kind of like their own kind of power or being able to voice, even though being an outsider? Were the teachers mostly European people?
Oh no, I'm sorry. I was the only white person anywhere around.
Where the teachers had any kind of power.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. All of the teaching community were Kenyans. They were educated in the Kenyan system. They'd all gone to Kenyan University. So I was the only American / Westerner anywhere around.
So you were really.
I was at the beginning. By the end, not as much.
Oh, so later on.
Mm-hmm. There was definitely evolution.
Once you got brown.
Once you got brown.
Once I got brown. But this is mostly what I wanted to talk about, sort of the gray areas that maybe we don't see from our white perspective, that we can't really understand because we don't know sort of the political and economic and social situation that influences all of the issues. But do you have any other questions before I show you the pictures?
I can just say for a second, I had somewhat of a different experience. I lived in Nairobi, the capital of Kenya, only for a summer, whereas she was in Kenya for a year, so she has, I would say, a much richer experience. But I had the urban experience, and I was living with a Kenyan family on the outskirts of town, and I was also the only white person in my area. And was working for a non-governmental organization, a national organization called Girl Child Network that was really trying to focus its attention on a lot of the issues that Jim mentioned. So they were really trying to, it was a membership organization, so like 250 organizations around the country were coming together, and some were focusing on direct intervention and counseling, others were focusing on the legal aspects of trying to really get the law to, a new law had been passed about child rights, which was really exciting. This was two summers ago. And they were trying to really push the law as far as it could go, working on issues of female genital mutilation, which is still practiced there, working on issues of girls being encouraged to get an education, which as Jim mentioned is a huge issue. So I was there for an internship for my graduate degree, but also trying to figure out whether I wanted to establish a career living and working in a developing country. And I also have a million stories I'd be happy to share. So, what kind of question?
Yeah.
What's the population of Kenya?
I probably shouldn't even say, because I'll be making it up, but I feel like it's around 4 million, maybe 5.
4 million?
I'm really not sure. I knew probably the first week that I was there, but I forgot.
So that's almost half the population, because you said about 2 million are
affiliated. Yeah, but I feel like it's not half the population, so maybe there's more than half.
Wow. seems to me smart countries have had that big problems, you know, that kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these problems are, I mean, each country has their unique problems. Each country in Africa has unique problems, but a lot of them are facing similar issues.
Jenny, do you want questions now? Are you going to show pictures? Or
what? I am going to show pictures.
What's the format?
Well, I've got about a 15-minute slideshow. Music and stuff. You can see the school that
because
I was.
You painted a fairly sad and gloomy picture in a sense. What rays of light do you see from your experience?
Those are almost harder to talk about because they're not as well defined. The community that I lived in was lovely.
Mm-hmm.
They were wonderful. a week before I was leaving, I told the village counselor, who's a really important man in the community, I told him that I was leaving in a few days. I said, you know, I'm going in just a few days. And he said, what? You're leaving us? I said, I am. And I'm very sad that I'm going to be going soon. And he said, we should have never taken you into this community. I said, why do you say that? He said, because now we will have to learn to live without you. And he didn't mean it in that way to be, you know, well, we should have never taken you in. It wasn't that. It was just that he was telling me in his Kenyan way that I was a part of them and that I was one of them there, and that my absence would be felt. There are three individuals that I taught with, three teachers that were my best friends. They welcomed me into their homes, into their lives. They were all the light of my year. They were just incredible people. You see a lot of pictures of them. They were predominant, for the most part, they were a woman named Judy, who was a woman that had two children. Her husband was pressuring her to have more. She didn't want to. She wanted to continue with her education to get her master's degree, but was receiving opposition from her community and from her family that she should be having children instead. She was one of my best friends. And then two other men named Jack and Morris, who were the ones that were attacked in the strike and were chased away from the school. So the last 2 weeks that I was there, they were gone. They never came back. So I never really got to see them say goodbye. But I spent most of my time, I pretty much lived at their house, except for sleeping there. Yeah. Yeah, but the rays of light were the everyday things. It was the majority of things, I guess. And I hope that you'll see that from my pictures. I hope that comes across.
I did come away with a tremendous heaviness as well, feeling like this is one of the most developed countries on a continent of 52 countries. And the problems run so deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable.
It's true.
So that was extremely sobering as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And the people are aware of their issues. They're not blind to them. They know, and they're angry and they're bitter about the stuff that they're working against, especially because often people are in opposition to their government. But their everyday approach to life is generally they're loving and living just like they are.
Yeah. This reminds me a little bit of my Native American communities. One of the things is gaining the respect of we as people from our tribes and our reservations when considered like outsiders or white people coming in is gaining the respect of the community. We were having to do with, I can call them non-Indians here, but we've known to call them white people. And to gain the respect of our Native communities is how we were able to start accepting some of our non-Indian people in our Native communities.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to what you're talking about.
I was very humbled to be welcomed or to be accepted as it was.
What possibilities of deterring Western man from the same fate today have been considered? Homeschooling, computer, to instill fear in man's heart for any reason is wrong. And that's all man, neighbor, red, yellow, black, and white.
So what are you asking about?
what precautions can be taken to deter Western societies from instilling fear in the hearts of man? We're dropping bombs over there today.
Yes, we are. We'll have that conversation later in the cafeteria if you want. That is definitely an extension of what experience. But I'm supposed to put my slides on now, so.